everybody, and welcome back to this week's episode, where I interview a guest who is so salty and so sassy, I couldn't help but just fall in love with his view of the world. I'm going to let John Paul introduce himself, but I do need to say that his journey began at rock bottom. John Paul was struggling with addiction, and he finally reached that point where he decided, I can't do this anymore. And so he began the long journey towards sobriety. And that journey, well, he talks about it in this episode. And it's actually a fascinating tale. So not only has he become a sobriety coach for those who need help, but he's also developed this method of breathwork that is changing lives. I don't want to spoil everything by giving an overly long intro, but I think I do want to say that John Paul is one of those people you're going to meet that's larger than life, that tells you like it is, and will leave no stone unturned in order to help you heal. So here's my next interview with kind of the unstoppable force of nature that is John Paul Crimi.
There's a lot there to unpack. One of the things is that you can't help everybody. You can't save everybody as much as you want to. It's a hard truth that I've had to face over and over and over again. I've had a lot of people die, way too many. And then the other truth is that maybe you can help the people around them.
To get up on stage, which we know you have. You've gotten up on stage many times over, and you have to introduce yourself to a group of people. How would you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't, you know, it's not fun sometimes to introduce yourself, you know, because you sound like an ego. I feel like I sound like an egomaniac if I was going to introduce myself. It's much easier when someone else says, oh, he's this amazing breathwork guy who changes lives with breathwork. And he's worked with all these celebrities, Oscar winners, Grammy winners, gold medalists, right? It's like, I feel like an egomaniac saying that about myself, but it's the truth. And I honestly believe that the type of breathwork that I teach, the style of breathwork that I teach, I believe that I'm the best person on the planet doing this, in the sense that, like, I have put so much time and energy and effort and work into making what I do incredible and being the best at it, that I just don't think there's anybody else out there doing it as good as me. Now, there are going to be people who don't like me and don't like my style and how I do it. And I'm okay with that. I'm totally fine with that. You can't be true to yourself, authentic, and give a shit what people think about you. So I'm unapologetically myself in a way that, you know, like I said earlier, I'm waiting to get canceled. So that's me. I'm from Boston originally. I grew up on the South Shore of Boston, which is one of the most Irish places in America. I grew up in the fifth most Irish town in America, surrounded by the 13 most Irish towns in America. It's called the Irish Riviera. So people are always like, oh, Jean-Paul, are you French? Are you French? I'm like, I am not French. I'm Irish, Italian, and Scottish, which means I like to drink a lot. I don't want to pay for it. And then I want to start a fight. But I don't do those things anymore. I'm sober 26 years. And I am a kind, loving person to myself and to others. So I don't know if that's a good introduction or not, but it's real.
I accept that introduction. I accept it. I am also a descendant of the Scottish Isle. So you and I have that in common, which I kind of love.
Nice.
That means this is going to be boisterous and fun, and I'm looking forward to it. Let me ask you a question. So when you were growing up, what did you dream of becoming?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know what age it started at, but I started acting when I was pretty young. I think it was like 10 or 11. I was in a local theater group and I did a radio play that I was the star of. And then I did some plays on stage. And I really loved the idea of being an actor. I liked the attention I got. And then later, when I got into drugs and alcohol, I really liked the idea of being an actor, because I thought you can get away with whatever you want when you're famous, right? Famous people can do anything they want and people still love them and they get away with whatever they want. And so originally fell in love with acting itself. And then I fell in love with the idea of fame later.
I think the idea of fame is kind of intoxicating.
Yeah.
It's like a little addictive. It's like, I don't know. There's something about it that is, I don't know. I would not handle it well. I'm just telling you that I would become a monster.
Most people don't, and I've worked with a lot of famous people, like an absurd amount of famous people. And it's everyone thinks it's like money, right? There's a saying about money. Everyone knows it's not going to fix you, but they want to find out for themselves, right? Fame is the same way. Everyone thinks, oh, that person can't handle fame, but I can handle fame. I would be able to handle it. And they can't. It's really hard. Very, very few people can actually handle fame. They just can't. It's not normal. It's really weird. It's really uncomfortable. I've been with massively famous people and seen the paparazzi chasing us down. And I've been with people where we're trying to do things and I'm trying to say something to someone to save their life because they're going to die. And someone has to come up and get a selfie with them right then in that moment. I have to have a selfie. I don't care, that you're in this conversation. I don't care that wherever you are, whatever you're doing, have to have a selfie. And it's a constant, and there's no privacy. I had a very close friend who, he couldn't go to the supermarket and buy groceries because people would film what he was putting in his cart and put it on the internet. So there's just, you just have no idea what it's like until you see it up close. It's not as glamorous as people think.
No, it sounds exhausting.
It is.
Yes. So you're a kid. You're kind of like dreaming about what you're going to become. You're an actor. Are you surprised where you've ended up?
Yeah. I mean, I think most people, nobody thinks their life is going to work out the way it actually does. I say this in my class all the time when people are doing the breathwork, I go, nobody's life has worked out the way you thought it was going to work out. So why are you holding on to that thing? Why are you holding on to that resentment of this thing that didn't work out? Nobody's life. Like I'm this breathwork teacher. And when I do live classes, I do classes online, but I do them live. We have gongs and I have a big gong behind me. Never in my wildest dreams that I would think that I would be up on stage with a freaking gong behind me. Like, I'm from South Boston. I didn't even know what a gong was. Like, gongs didn't exist in my universe. Breathwork, all these things. I didn't even know this world was available to me. Even when I started doing it, I didn't think I was going to be a breathwork teacher. People kept asking me. They said, you're so different all of a sudden. Like, you're like more present and you're happy and you seem like a different guy. Are you medicated all of a sudden? Like, what's going on with you? I had such a drastic change. And I had been sober 12 years when this happened. I had such a drastic change from the breathwork that people were like, what is going on with you? My clients, my friends. And I was like, oh, I'm doing this weird breathing thing. And it's like, it's really making me feel good about myself and my life. And they're like, show me. And so I started showing people, and then more people asked me to show them. And then someone asked me to do a class. And I was like, I don't even want people to know I'm doing this. I'm like embarrassed about it. It's weird. It's woo-woo. It's new agey. And then I had the realization that like, maybe if somebody taught this in a way that wasn't weird and new agey and woo-woo, that taught it like East Coast, edgy, funny, whatever, that lots of other people could have this experience that I'm having and they could heal some of the stuff that they've been carrying their whole lives and be happy with themselves and their life. And I was right. I was right. But it took a while for me to accept that that's what I was going to do. In fact, it took Matthew Perry, who we'll probably get into, a dear friend of mine, came to one of my first classes and he's like, this is what you're supposed to do. This is your gift. I know you want a TV show, but this is your gift. And I was like, oh God, the breath work. I don't even want people to know about it. And so, it's just, sometimes it's like, you're pulled by the universe. That sounded woo woo. Ugh.
Well, I love how, I don't know, you're just unabashedly yourself. And I appreciate that. It's, you're such a breath of fresh air, frankly. I just want to say that. Because you've gone through what I think I'm understanding or hearing from you is that you've had some dark nights of the soul. And
like, dark years of the soul. Are you kidding me? Yeah, dark years of the soul. I've been in that darkness for years and know what that's like. I've been on the edge and know what that's like. And yeah, so I've been to the bottom and now I have a very beautiful life. And so it takes, you know, it's pretty amazing to go from there to where I am now today. It's hard to believe in some ways.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to ask the second question because I'm actually really curious. The second question is, did you grow up in a religious household? If so, what did that look like? And has that kind of, if you have a connection to something outside yourself, the divine, how has that evolved over time?
Whew, there's a lot to unpack there. So buckle in, girl.
Okay.
All right. So I grew up in a religious household, Catholic in Boston, right? You know, and I was an altar boy in the Catholic Church in Boston, one of the most dangerous jobs out there. Nothing happened to me. Anyways, so I was an altar boy. My dad was a Eucharistic minister who gives the bread at church, you know. And, you know, I was baptized, I was confirmed. I went to Catholic school for 3 years and they asked me to leave. I was a little too rowdy for Catholic school. And so I know quite a bit about Catholicism and it didn't ever resonate with me. Like it wasn't, you know, you can't ask the questions, you know, why, how did they get the two animals on the ark? Like all the animals and how these animals, they attack each other. They're natural predators of each other. How do they all live on the ark? You know, don't ask any questions, you know? So I had a real problem with Catholicism growing up and I got in a lot of trouble. And, I was so bored in church. I hated church so much that I used to just check out in my head. But I'm also really just deeply honest with, you know, who I am. And it's taken a long time to get comfortable in my skin.
And yeah, I mean, so many of the guests that I've had on the show that grew up, especially they had an inciting incident when they were a kid where they asked a question and it was not favorably received by those in power or those in charge. And it kind of, you know, either they were asked to leave or it just as a kid felt not safe enough or not comfortable enough that they chose to then, you know, kind of walk away either then or a few years later. But it's definitely, you know, it doesn't just happen in Catholicism, absolutely across the board. Kids, when they ask questions, they're not really, it's not really approved of, you know. A favorite one that kids have told me or people have told over and over asking about the dinosaurs, you know, kids love dinosaurs. I mean, they just love them. And so well, then you go to church and you ask and it's, you know, kind of, they get shut down and it kind of ruins everything.
Yeah.
Kids are naturally curious. They are in love with the world. They want to know about it. So, you know, you referenced these dark years of the soul that you went through. Mm-hmm. When you were going through them, when you were, you know, at varying degrees of these experiences, it sounds like you really didn't have a divine kind of anchor to reach to.
That's great. You know, I have had spiritual experiences. I have had profound spiritual experiences and we can go into those.
Okay.
I'd love to go into them. And I don't go into them very often. So this is going to be a special podcast. So, you know, when I was at that dark night of the soul, it wasn't that I didn't think there was a God. I just didn't think he was listening to me or they were listening to me. Right. We close ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit or whatever it is you want to call. And you get, it gets so dark that you can't see the light and you can't feel it. And I actually had a moment, you know, where I was like, I was 2 weeks sober. And, you know, part of the recovery program, 12-step recovery, is you have to find a higher power, right? You have to, and I think before I even got that sober, before I even had that 2 weeks, I think I asked God, like, God, help me. Like, I don't know what to do here, right? And then I was 2 weeks sober and I was like, I was arguing with everybody at work. I was really struggling, was having a hard time. And I was walking out to my car and I was like, God, whatever your will is today, whatever you want, I'm whatever it's supposed to be. I surrendered, as they say, to God. And I went to work and they called me up into the office and they fired me. And I was like, wait, you can't fire me. I'm the best salesman here. Like, nobody's better than me. And they're like, yeah, but you can't headbutt the fellow employees. Like, I'm like, that guy had it coming. He totally deserved it. So I got fired and I went to a, you know, a 12-step recovery meeting and I shared the story and they all laughed. And it was actually such a gift because I was able to build my life, my business around my recovery. I went to that meeting every day. It was a men's, you know, 12-step recovery meeting. And I built my new business working for myself around my sobriety. I put that first. I put the sobriety first. And I've learned along the way. I've had a lot of mentors. I've had a lot of amazing coaches and teachers. You know, whatever you put in front of sobriety will be removed, right? And whatever you put in front of your higher power will be removed. So I have to get my priorities in alignment. And so, you know, it really comes down to, you know, higher power, God, whatever you want to call it, sobriety, you know, work, family. And you're like, whoa, did you put work before family? And you go, yeah, because if I don't work, I can't take care of my family. I can't support my family. I have to feed them. I have to take care of them, right? And it's, so it's not that work is more important. That it's not that work means more to me. It's important because it's how I take care of these people that I love. And it's right there. It's right there, you know? So I'm not conflicted inside about what my priorities are. Because everyone says family first, but then, you know, they're working more than their family. And they're spending time with their family. So just getting clear on what those priorities are is really important.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I'm just like, I'm going to need to think about this, his response a little bit later because it was so profound. So thank you.
Well, this coach that did this for me, he actually had me get it up and write it on a whiteboard. And he's like, you know, this is before I had my own family. They're like, you know, what's first? Family first. He's like, yeah, everybody says that because it sounds right. But he goes, when was the last time you talked to your family? I'm like, oh God, I mean, they're on the East Coast, never. And he's like, yeah, exactly. So he lined it out for me. He goes, and this is how you test it. If you have your family, but you don't have a job, are you okay? No. Because I have to take care of my family. So then that means the job comes a little bit before the family. If you have your family, but you don't have sobriety, is that okay? No, I have to be sober because if I'm not sober, I'm a terrible dad. I'm a terrible husband. Oh, okay. So then sobriety goes before the family. If you have a work, but you don't have sobriety, is that okay? No, I have to be sober for work. Okay. So sobriety goes before work. If you have sobriety, but you don't have God, are you okay? No. Right? So every fear that I do this with the guys that I sponsor and that I help in 12-step, every fear comes down to being alone. And if I'm alone, I'm going to be in emotional pain. And if I'm in emotional pain long enough, I'm going to either drink or I'm going to kill myself. But if I have some higher power, if I have some God, then I'm never truly alone. So every fear can come back to, I'm not connected right now to my higher power. I'm not connected to God, whatever that is.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That's why I love mentors. I love teachers. I love coaches because, you know, invariably as the human line progresses, people are going to come up with more brilliant and insightful and just incredible ways to I don't know, to connect, to create community, to do whatever you want to do in this world. And so that gives me hope, actually, as I look around what's going on in the world. So I want to ask you, because I know you're going to give an answer that's really powerful and potent. When you finally decided, hey, I'm going to do this sober thing, I'm going to enter in to this world, you know, that might be intimidating, might be a little scary, will absolutely be a lot of work. Did you, as you were entering and as you began it, did you think to yourself, wow, who am I? And how do I figure that out? Because I would suspect that you, pre-sober life, were a little different than post, you know, when you entered sobriety.
Yeah. I mean, I was changing mentally, physically, emotionally. You know, I lost my hair. I have alopecia, right? And so I was losing my hair. I was in a battle with my hair for almost 2 years and taking a lot of stuff, you know, that the doctors had me on, getting cortisone shots in my eyebrows and in my head. And it was really painful. So I was losing my identity, which was wrapped up in my looks, right? Because I was an actor. I had studied method acting for years and done all the acting things. And I was also trying to be a fitness model. So I was all about the outsides, and that was being stripped away. And so it's really interesting. You know, there was a total surrender at one point, finally, where it was like, I don't know how to live my life anymore. I just give up. I give up. It's a bottom, a surrender, whatever you want to call it. And I asked for help. And that's a really difficult thing for a man or any person really to do. You know, there's a lot of conflict, internal or external conflict, where you go like, I've screwed up my life so bad, or I'm so unhappy inside that I'm willing to take direction, advice from a total stranger. Like from some just guy at a meeting, you know, some random dude at a meeting who's like calling himself an alcoholic too. And it's like, okay, I'll let this guy seems like he knows what's up. I'll let this guy fucking tell me how to run my life and take direction from this guy. You know, it takes you really have to hit a bottom to get there. And, you know, cause I was like, I'm a real self-will, self-motivated, I can do it, whatever I set my mind to type of guy, but I could not get sober on my own. I had get like 10 days and drink. I'd get 20 days and drink. I get 30 days and drink. And then I was just like, oh God. And I went through that for like a year. Finally, I was like, I don't know how to do this. I really can't do it on my own. I need help. And I think that there's a moment there. There's like a beautiful moment of grace when you ask for help, whether it's from God or another human being. And for a while, that was my God. That was my higher power. It's like one man helping another man and getting nothing in return. But I got so much in return. You get so much in return when you get to help another person change their life. It's so powerful. So that's where I found God for a long time, was in working with others, helping others. It's really beautiful. It's really powerful what happens in those moments.
Yeah. I mean, there's two things I want to respond to. One is that, you know, especially that vocation of actor, right? I'm going to make a generalized statement here. In the world, if you want to be an actor, people, I think, primarily respond to looks, first of all. That's just the way of the world. Even outside of acting, you know, that's just the way, I guess, the human mind or brain or whatever, that's how we like figure things out, is what do people look like? And so I can't imagine being under that inordinate amount of stress. You know, you have this amazing, incredible passion for acting since you're a kid. And then you have this experience of alopecia. I'm sorry, you want to say something? Go ahead.
No, you're spot on. And I was ridiculously good looking and like handsome, like, and very humble about it too. No.
Clearly. clearly. Well, it's a loss, right?
Yeah, it's a loss. And it's a weird loss because, you know, there's other people who are struggling with cancer and like real things. So you can't, there's almost this like, dude, you're not dying. You're just losing your hair, right? Like there's that like discount of it where you give like, there's much worse things. You're just losing your hair, bro. You're fine. You know, there's people who are, so you discount it or I discounted it. Like there's other people who have much worse than I do. And so invalidating my own feelings at the time too, right? But it was real and it was hard. And I went through a massive change in that time, in that transformation. So I didn't look like the same guy. And at the same time, I was getting sober. So I actually let go of my hair 6 months into sobriety. I stopped the medication that the doctors had me on. I was taking, you know, this steroid that's like a, it's like a catabolic steroid. It's the opposite of what bodybuilders take. So I was working in Gold's Gym in Venice where all the bodybuilders were, but I'm taking fat steroids. It makes you fat. And I'm like, you know, it was just so awful. I'm a trainer on fat steroids and it was so bad. And I just said, fuck it, I'm done. Like, and the doctor's like, you're going to lose your hair. You're going to lose your eyebrows. They're not going to come back. And I was, and I said, you know, if that's what God wants for me, that's what it's supposed to be. Because I can't live like this anymore because the medicine was just killing me. And I let it go. And it was in the process. It was in the first, you know, 6 months of sobriety. So I'm already going through the toughest time in my life, which is sobriety. And then I lose all my hair. I go completely bald 6 months into sobriety. No hair, no eyebrows, nothing. So really a metamorphosis, a huge change. And like having to accept that, having to accept that, like, this is what I look like now. You know, I literally remember looking down the aisle of treadmills when I was talking to a client and not recognizing myself and be like, who's that weird looking guy? And then I went, wait, that's me? Like, that's what I look like? I didn't recognize myself. And my client's like, what's going on now? Are you okay? I'm like, oh, I'm having a moment. I'm having a real weird moment here. And they're like, yeah, it looks like it. And, you know, just having to like accept that. That I'm, this is who I am now. This is what I look like now. And so I dug really deep into the work around like, I'm not my hair. I'm not my hair. I'm not my looks. You know, if your whole identity is wrapped up in this thing, whether it's, oh, I'm a mother, I'm a great mom, or I'm a successful businessman, or I'm this, or I'm that, and that gets stripped away, you know, where do you go? Mm-hmm. And I dug deeper into the work of like, I'm not my hair. I'm not my body. I'm not this. I'm not that. And it forced me on a real journey of like soul searching.
Yeah, I really appreciate your use of the term metamorphosis because I was thinking that it's like God or the universe was like, you're in the wrong place. Okay. You're like literally in the wrong place. So we need to put you in the right place. And all of these things are going to need to happen to get you here so that you can do this work that you're doing now for people.
Yeah.
I would imagine that when you began your modality and the breath work, you had no idea that you'd be working with celebrities. And I mean, I don't think you, I mean, was it just a little surreal for you?
No. So I was working with celebrities before the breath work. So I was, you know, I worked with celebrities in three different careers, actually. So it's interesting. So I worked with celebrities as a trainer. I was a celebrity trainer and I had a lot of really famous people that I trained. And then I became a celebrity sobriety coach, sober coach. And so I went on the road with bands and I went on movie sets with celebrities. And then I worked with celebrities as a breathwork coach. So I've worked with a ton of celebrities in all three of my careers. And, you know, I thought I should be, there was this ego part of me that wanted to be a celebrity. And it's kind of ironic. It's like, you know, you wanted to be this person. And instead God's like, no, you're going to help these people. Instead of being a famous celebrity, you're going to help celebrities. And I'm like, really? I think I should be a celebrity. No. You got to help these people. So yeah, I've actually worked with celebrities in three different careers. I worked with a ton of celebrities. That's why I'm saying was like, I've seen more fame than most people have seen. And I've traveled with them all over and I've, you know, done all the things. Like, you know, I know what it feels like to be a rock star on the road. I mean, I'm not up on the stage, but I know what it's like to be on a movie set for weeks and months at a time. You know, I know what it's like to be on a show, a TV show, and all these different things, you know, to get on the private plane. I know the celebrity lifestyle. I've traveled, I've done it in three different capacities.
Wow. That is actually a little bizarre, I have to say. And and fascinating, because it's like the third time's the charm, right? I think it's, would you agree? I don't know.
I don't know either. I just, you know, I think I'm not that impressed by them, you know, and maybe that's why, like, I'm like, okay, whatever, you're famous, like, give me 20 pushups. Okay, whatever, you're famous, like, let's get sober, stop talking shit, you know? Okay, you're famous, whatever, let's breathe, let's do the breath work, you know? Come on, like, that doesn't impress me anymore. It didn't impress me once I started meeting these people. I was like, oh, they're not that special. They have a talent, they're gifted at whatever it is they do, or they've worked really hard at whatever it is they do, but they're lacking in a lot of other areas.
Yeah.
As we all are, like we all are deficient in a lot of ways.
We all have our blind spots. Bless our little hearts. Matthew Perry, when you were kind of struggling to become a successful actor, was it a long
no,
time?
No. So
ago?
I was a trainer. Well, I was a screenwriter. So when I lost my hair, I decided I'm done with acting. I'm going to write. Right. And I started writing and I had a little bit of success with the writing. And so I was a screenwriter, but you know, it's hard to make a living as a screenwriter out of the gate. So I was, you know, a trainer and someone connected us. They said, you know, I think you'd be really good for Matthew. You know, he's back sober again. And I was sober. I was sober a couple of years. And I think you'd be great for him. So I became his trainer. So I started out as his trainer. And we became very good friends through that. We fast friends. And we hung out all the time. And we did all kinds of things. And then I started traveling all over with him and helping him in other capacities. And so that's where it started. And I actually found the breath work through Matthew. We were working out. And he had done a breathwork session with somebody. Well, he had done a weird like healing session with somebody. And one of the aspects of it was breathwork. And he was telling me about it. And I said, that sounds like nonsense. It sounds like the guy's trying to asphyxiate you or something. And he goes, well, I bought you a session with this guy because you're my only friend who's open-minded enough to try it. And like, I want to talk to somebody about it. So I said, all right, cool, I'll do it. So I went and did this session with this guy. And it was a different style of breathwork than the one that I teach now, but it was still really incredible and profound. And I had like kind of an awakening. And the next day, my head was turned off. And I was super present in a way that I'd never been before, kind of like Eckhart Tolle talks about in The Power of Now. I had that experience. And I started going down a rabbit hole of breathwork after that. I started doing all these different breathworks and then I took Matthew through a session of the style that I teach now. And he's like, holy shit, that's amazing. And then he came to my first class and he's like, this is what you're supposed to do, right? So Matthew is like, I credit him for the beginning of the journey. I really do.
Yeah. Wow. You never know where inspiration is going to come from or who it's going to come through. That's one of the reasons I tell everyone, you know, even though I do hate rolling out of bed every morning, it's also exciting because you never know what kind of encounter you're going to have or experience that might just change your entire life. So,
It actually started before that because Matthew and I were following the Los Angeles Kings, the hockey team. And it just happened to be 2012, the season that they went on the run for the Stanley Cup. And so we were actually flying around to the playoff games. It was like this amazing thing. And we were hanging out with the players after the games. And it was such an incredible experience, right? And I'm a big hockey fan. And then it's the last game. It's the Stanley Cup. It's like game six. They're about to win the cup. They're up and it's in between periods. And we're in this little VIP room underneath the Staples Center. And, you know, Will Ferrell's in there and Vince Vaughn and Zac Efron. And I'm meeting, you know, talking to all these celebrities. And in walks Tony Robbins. And I go, holy shit, it's Tony Robbins. And Matthew goes, really? Every celebrity in LA is in here right now. We've been following the Kings all season. They're about to win the cup. And you're excited about a gigantic man. And I go, yeah, he's amazing. I had his books since, you know, high school. I had his tapes in high school. He goes, well, go tell him. I go, no, I don't want to be the guy that goes up to him like everybody goes up to you. And so I walk back through the tunnel and Tony's looking at his phone and he looks up and he goes, hey man, how's it going? And I go, yeah, I never do this. I know everybody says that, but I actually don't. I'm a huge fan of your work. Like, I love what you do. And he goes, well, have you ever been to my seminar? And I go, no. He goes, I only do three domestically a year, but I'd love it if you come as my personal VIP guest next month to San Jose. And I was like, what? Get out of here. And he's like, no, come. Here's my secretary's information. She'll take care of you. So he put me in his seminar, VIP side of the stage comped. And I had an experience in there. I had a life-changing experience in there. And in the experience, which is something I do in my class, we're pulling moments into our heart. And I had a moment where I was just like, I'm done with Hollywood. I'm done with screenwriting. I'm done with trying to be a Hollywood whatever. I'm just going to help people. I'm going to help people, whatever that looks like, whatever that's supposed to be, whatever God wants for me, that's what I'm going to do. Because that's what I'm good at. And at the end of my life will have been worthwhile, will have meaning because I helped some people along the way. And when I came back, that's when I found the breathwork. That was the tool by which I would change thousands of people's lives on this planet. And so I kind of combined what I learned from Tony with this breathwork and took the woo-woo new aginess out of the breathwork and was like, I'm going to do this in a cooler way. And so I took the technique and I repackaged it and added cool music and did it my way, my style. Like if I'm going to do this weird fucking breathwork thing, excuse my language, if I'm going to do this weird breathwork thing, then I'm going to do it in my way. I'm going to do it in a way that I don't give a shit, you know, and it's like maybe other people will resonate with it. Maybe other angry East Coast guys and stressed out housewives and, you know, people with trauma will go like, that's my guy. Like that guy, if that guy can change his life with breathing, I'll come try it. And that's what I did. And it took a couple of years, but eventually I was right. Eventually the classes were sold out and packed and insane. And celebrities had their assistants calling like, I know the class is sold out, but can I get Owen Wilson in the class? And, you know, like all these people were trying to get in my classes. And it was wild. I'd look down and there'd be just like tons of celebrities like in my class. And it was just, it was a trip. They were coming there for me. And it was like, huh, this is different than I had planned.
We were talking about spiritual experiences earlier, and I'm curious about this. So for me, because I'm someone who sees meaning in most everything that happens in my life. So, you know, you and Matthew are on this hockey adventure extravaganza flying all over and you're in the, you know, VIP room and all of these celebrities are around you. And then in walks Tony Robbins. And then because of that encounter and his generosity of spirit in giving you that pass for the VIP area. And then you go to the seminar and you have this almost like inception point in your life where you understand suddenly the direction you want to go in your life. For me, that is just, it's like synchronicity. It's like the universe leading you to this experience. I mean, would you say that encounter with Tony Robbins, would you classify it as a spiritual experience?
It's a moment. It's a moment where you meet someone and then you have this choice, this thing, which way am I going to go? And when I went to his seminar, I had a spiritual experience in the seminar. Like he induced in a spiritual experience in a way by what he was doing. I had it in there, in the moments. And And I've had, and now it's like when I hear Tony, I feel connected to my spirit because of what he did, you know, he created it. And then I had a spiritual experience doing the breath work, like the deepest, most profound spiritual experience I've ever had doing the breath work. And I've had it several times, and I've had lots of people out there have a spiritual experience in the breath work as well. I don't say that. I've never said that on a podcast because I don't want to set up that expectation, like come do this breath work and there's going to be a spiritual experience, because it's different for everybody and it's different every time you do it. Some people, their trauma comes up for them and then they're like, oh my God, I just experienced the trauma. I'm like, you didn't experience the trauma. The trauma was already there. The breath work is just showing you it needs to be healed. It needs to be worked on, right? So, but some people have these beautiful spiritual experiences in the breath work. I've had like people that I don't want to say gangbangers, but what I perceived or what someone who might be a gangbanger come up to me after the class and be like, can I talk to you? I'm like, yeah, we're talking. He's like, no, over here. And he's like, I felt the presence of God. I felt a spiritual experience in the breath work. Is that normal? I'm like, for some people, yes. Other people, you know, they're visited by relatives that are passed, and other people just feel gratitude and love. And other people are like, whoa, what the hell was that? That was way weirder. You know, everybody has a different experience. And so I can't say what's going to happen for you. But that guy came and it changed him. And it's powerful to watch. And I've watched that happen a lot for years. I've been doing this for 15 years. So I have people come and then they have this profound experience and then they stay for a while and they change their lives. And I watch it. And so to me, it's like, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. And they're like, they're shocked by it. They're like, you know, blown away. But I'm like, yeah, that's what happens when you do the work on yourself.
Beautiful.
Your life changes.
Yeah, beautiful. I love it. Thank you for sharing that. That makes me so happy. I love meeting people who are making this world a more beautiful place. And yes, you are doing just that. I'd love to ask the main question, which is, I would so appreciate if you would share one story or two stories, however many you feel comfortable with, about something that maybe you witnessed or that's happened in your life that you consider to be magical, mysterious, or miraculous.
Okay. This is kind of a heavy story. So I don't know. It's not like I don't know if it's uplifting, but I think it's pretty incredible. Okay. So I worked with a guy as a sober coach, sober companion, and on a detox, and he was really bad. He was drinking, you know, a liter and a half of vodka a day. And, you know, I helped him get off that. We detoxed him. And then I did a breathwork session with him, which was really profound for him. And I don't want to say who he was, so I'm going to leave that out, but he was very well known and in this certain world, and he created a lot, and he died 9 months later. He didn't want to get sober. He didn't want to do the work, and it was heartbreaking. And, you know, this was in Los Angeles, in San Diego, right, that this guy lived and that I helped him. And then I think it was less than a year later, I was living in LA. I just happened to do a class in Eugene, Oregon. And, you know, it was a class of probably like 50 people. And there was a woman in there and her daughter, and she was crying. And I know what the cries sound like. I know what breakups cry sounds like. I know what grief sounds like. I know all the different cries. I know what, I can feel it. And I thought, wow, she's going through some heavy grief. And her daughter was crying. And she messaged me afterwards and she said, thank you so much. I've been going through some tough grief. My brother so-and-so died. And, you know, I said, yeah, I know your brother. I did a detox on him 9 months ago or whatever it was. And she said, that's crazy. My daughter felt like there was a connection between you two. She said, I feel like there's a connection between John Paul and so-and-so. And I guess he's still leading me. I guess he's still helping me. So, you know, it was a profound experience.
Also, just to me, it illustrates how much that we're actually a lot closer to each other than we understand.
Yeah. there's a lot there to unpack. One of the things is that you can't help everybody. You can't save everybody as much as you want to. It's a hard truth that I've had to face over and over and over again. I've had a lot of people die, way too many. And then the other truth is that maybe you can help the people around them who want the help, who are ready for the help, who need the help.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry for the loss of the gentleman that you were working with. You know, I can barely have two drinks. Actually, as I get older, I can't drink any more alcohol at all anymore because our bodies change. But I can't imagine what that's like to lose someone because, and I might be projecting here, but I don't think I am. That relationship between sobriety coach and the person who is wanting to maintain sobriety, I would imagine it's a pretty vulnerable and intimate one. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you learn everything about the person most times, especially if you're living with them. Yeah, it's heartbreaking. You know, you can't want it for people more than they want it for themselves. And I've lost a lot of people along this journey. And I say this all the time, like grief is just love with no place to go. You know, I miss Matthew. I love Matthew. And, you know, I wish I could reach out to him and be like, oh my God, did you see the hockey game, USA versus America? Like, who would you root for that? Because you're Canadian, right? But, you know all these guys. Like, you know, we know all these guys. Like, I can't call him. I can't reach out to him. And so it's, my heart hurts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, I think I'm sorry about the loss of Matthew too. I can't even imagine. I think part of the getting sober process, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is you as the client have to be ready to be insanely vulnerable and open. Just be ready for whatever is going to come if you want to be successful. Would you say that's correct?
Well, I think when you get sober, whether you want to be or not, you're going to be vulnerable and open because the drugs, the alcohol is numbing you out from your feelings. I took, you know, the drugs, the alcohol, it wasn't my problem. It was my solution to how I feel. I don't want to feel, so I want to take this thing that's going to make me not feel, or I want to feel different, right? So when I stop taking that thing, now I'm feeling all the feelings, whether I like it or not. And so it's all right there. You're like a raw nerve. You're not numb anymore. So you're going to feel whatever you're going to feel. And I tried to give people as much grace as I could because I knew that, you know, I was meeting them at their worst time in their life, like hitting rock bottom. And so it's hard. And people, you know, the things they say and do, and some people I couldn't help. They were just too, they weren't ready, you know. They're not ready. You have to be ready to some extent, or you have to be willing to do the work on yourself. Yeah. Whether it's in sobriety or breath work, there's the work and the title of breath work, right? You have to be willing to do the work. If you're not willing to show up and do the work, then nothing's going to change.
Yeah. And I mean, I do think, I don't know, I'm really hard on myself. So when I am not successful the first time doing something, mm-hmm. sometimes I'll say, oh, I just can't do it. And I think it's really important to remember, you know, whether you're trying meditation for the first time or you're trying breath work or, you know, whatever that looks like, you're trying to become sober. We're all going to fail at some yeah. point, you know, and maybe we'll fail multiple times, but it's just getting back up on the horse and trying it again.
What are you getting out of being so hard on yourself?
You know, that's a great question. I think I've been doing it since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I had to do it since I was a kid. I already know because of, I grew up overseas and just the state of my family, let's say, and some, you know, my mother went through a really hard time when I was little and I was the oldest. Did I mention that I was the oldest?
No.
And so it was very much all about being perfect 100% of the time, because if I was, then my mother's burden was lessened. You know, and then I had a younger brother and a younger sister, and there was a lot of mayhem growing up, and, you know, they acted out in their various ways. I never acted out ever.
Yeah. Because your role was the perfect daughter.
Exactly.
We take these roles on in the family and these archetypes. Right.
Yeah.
But you know, I say in my class all the time, which I'm, I can't wait to get you in, which is give yourself permission to suck. You don't have to be the best at doing breathwork. Just literally let yourself suck. Suck in the air. Let yourself suck at breathwork. You're just laying on the floor breathing. You don't have to be the best at it, right? Because that's been one of the biggest shifts that I've made, because I was a perfectionist too. And when you can let go of that perfectionist and you can give yourself permission to suck, you can do anything. You can start anything. My daughter was, I was watching it with my daughter the other day. She was doing something she was new at. And she's like, I suck at this. I'm not going to do it. And I'm like, yeah, you suck at it. Let yourself suck at it till you're good at it. Like, give yourself permission to suck at it. And that changes everything. If you're so hard, like, stop beating yourself up, because that's not going to work. Like, that doesn't help the situation. That doesn't help you get better at anything. And so when we can stop being so hard on ourselves, I always say work hard on yourself, but don't be hard on yourself. So like, I'm going to make mistakes after this podcast. Fucking guaranteed I will make mistakes today, tomorrow, whatever. Can I stop? There's never going to come a time where I'm perfect and I stop making mistakes. It's not going to happen. So knowing that, okay, I'm going to keep making mistakes. What can I shift about that? I can shift how I treat myself when I make those mistakes. I can shift that I can stop being so hard on myself, because I have two children that I love more than anything in this universe. And I'm modeling for them me being hard on myself. I don't want them to be hard on myself. Do I want my kids to treat themselves the way I treat myself? Absolutely not. No way. So I got to model it for them, not tell them. I have to show them what it looks like to make a mistake. I have to apologize to them when I screw up, because I want to model for them that I'm wrong sometimes. And when I'm wrong, I can apologize. And this is what it looks like to say you're sorry and be wrong. And that's okay to be wrong.
I want to thank John Paul for being incredibly vulnerable during this interview and leading with his heart. He's found a way to be in the world that is so spacious and revelatory and generous. I think it would behoove all of us to figure out how we can be exactly the same. So I need to thank John Paul for all of his stories and for who he is. If you want to learn a little bit more about him and his work, the breath work, the healing, his story, there are going to be all sorts of delightful links in the episode show notes, so be sure to check those out. Please do consider leaving a rating or writing a review. I love doing this podcast, but those ratings and reviews, they mean so much, and I'm ever so grateful for each and every one. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like John Paul. Lead with your heart. I mean, in a world that is just so determined to break us down and make us feel helpless and hopeless, John Paul comes back and says, no, F off, forget it. Our way of being is in contact with others and being vulnerable and helping them to understand that they can rise above everything and that we too can be vulnerable and still feel safe. So lead with your heart and become the miracle that John Paul is in the world. Someone who leads by example, shares who he is, and helps the rest of us, slowly but surely, a little bit further down the road of our journeys.